On this episode of Still Loading, the History of Real-Time Strategy, Part 4. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval. We are finally back with some more history of RTS games. On the last episode of this series, we ended it with talking about Herzog Spy, the game that was considered to be the first, quote-unquote, true RTS game. Today, we are starting off the episode with talking about North and South for the NES. North and South was published by Infogrames for the Amiga and Atari ST, but its NES port is where most people know it from. It was initially released in September of 1989, and its NES port came out in 1990. This game is unique because it is one of the few games that has the setting of the Civil War. Arguably, though, this is less of an RTS than Herzog Spy. You don't really have a cursor to select units. You can't build any units per se. And the game combines a lot of other gameplay styles in it that are not RTS related. In fact, I would argue it's not an RTS at all. However, it does have RTS elements. You have three different types of units you can control in real-time battle. You can reinforce your units to make each army larger and increase the chances of victory. This game is more of a strategy game than an RTS, but the gameplay is still fun in its own right. Now let's go over how this game works. You can choose to either play as the Union or the Confederates, and can even select a year of the Civil War to determine where each side's units will start. Once the game begins in earnest, you are brought to a battle map screen of the US, and to clarify, it's the US during the time of the Civil War. From here, there are a lot of elements in play. First, let's start with the most obvious and basic one, combat. As you and your computer move your units around the map, kind of the way you do in Risk, you can claim state. However, if two opposing units meet, then the real-time portion of the game begins. The screen transitions, and you now control that army in a fight against the enemies. A typical army is composed of three cavalry units, six soldiers, and one cannon. Soldiers can fire their guns from a distance and move slowly. Cavalry are melee fighters and can move fast. Cannons can move at a decent speed but have a very slow fire rate. Whoever wipes out the opponent's units wins that battle and therefore takes control of the state it was fought in. Besides the battles, there are events that occur that are out of your control. There are storms that travel from state to state, and if a storm gets over top of an army on the map, that army cannot move until the storm passes. There are also trains that travel back and forth from state to state, one train in the north and one train in the south. This is where you get funds to build more armies. This is all done automatically, and when you accumulate enough funds, a new army will appear. However, both sides can rob these trains, and this is where the non-RTS gameplay elements come in. The game goes into a side-scrolling view. If your train is being robbed, you have to defend it, and if you are doing the robbing, you have to fight your way through to the engine and take the money. And there is still a lot more to this game, but since it's not a true RTS, I wanted to go over the elements of it that I found interesting. And I wanted to include this because of its Civil War setting and the fact that it was a popular game on the NES. So while it wasn't much of an RTS, I'm super impressed with it as a strategy action game overall. The next game on today's agenda is a big one, Powermonger, developed by Bullfrog Productions for the Amiga and Atari ST. It was released in 1990, but was later ported to numerous other platforms. The game was developed by legendary designer Peter Molyneux, who is probably most famous for creating the Fable series. Powermonger was an impressive feat of design and spectacle for the time. It boasted a full 3D map that the player could control their units on. The game had players controlling an army to, quote-unquote, conquer the world. The game is massive, and it cannot be understated how long a game of Powermonger would take to see through to its completion. The way it worked is players would see a large, zoomed-out version of the world map. Starting in the top left corner, they would hop from island to island, conquering the territory. When an island slash area selected, the screen would show a more zoomed in mini map version of the island where the player would click around on the different areas of it. But the main portion of the screen would be devoted to a 3D rendering of the area selected by the player on the island mini map. As the player scrolls around on the island, the 3D landscape changes to reflect the area that is currently selected. As the land is explored, there are towns that appear as well as civilian or military population. The objective on each island is to tip the scales in your favor by wiping out the enemy captains. Players know when the scales have tipped in their favor by a literal scale that appears on the HUD of the game. After they have taken control of an island, they can recruit the population of the island to join their army. To keep their armies healthy, players will have to gather food, which could be done by capturing more towns or by finding animals to hunt on the various islands. Food is really the only resource that players need to gather in this game. I mentioned before that if a player takes out an enemy captain, then they tip the scales in their favor. Well, if the enemy kills one of the player's captains, the opposite happens. In fact, if one of the player's captains is killed, all of the soldiers under their command will run back to whichever home island they came from. When giving orders to those captains, the farther away a captain is from the player's quote-unquote main character, the longer it takes to execute the order, which is kind of a cool attempt at realism in my opinion. The game boasted an impressive artificial life engine for its time, where each in-game person has their own name, sex, allegiance, vitals, age, and more. They also kind of went about their own business. They would go hunting or fishing or farming. These people were represented by 2D sprites that would appear on the 3D terrain of the island. Towns and trees and other objects were also in 2D. Players could turn the camera around the island to get better views when a mountain or something was blocking their view. But as amazing as these graphics and systems were for their time, in 2021, the UI is absolute garbage. The 3D game map almost appears as a projection in the middle of a war table, with a military general in the background looking onwards. The view of the table with the 3D map on it was almost entirely isometric, so it made it tough to really tell what you were looking at any given moment. All the controls for the camera, unit movement, actions, and more are all placed as table tiles around the 3D map that's hovering in the center. Want to rotate the angle? Gotta find the button in the midst of 15 other buttons. So while I respect the game for its scope and its incredibly advanced gameplay, its UI makes me happy how far the RTS genre has come, because this is not it. Powermonger also features a first for this series, an actual expansion pack. In 1991, an expansion pack called Powermonger World War I Edition was released. This expansion pack changed the game's setting from a fictional medieval kingdom in the original to World War I. In my opinion, Powermonger is one of the most important games on this list that I would argue is relatively unknown by many gamers. And while the UI is pretty awful, in my opinion, and the game is pretty light on battle mechanics, I really do feel like it helped bring the RTS genre to new heights, no pun intended. Get it? Because it had 3D mountains and hills? No, that's it for Powermonger, so on to the next game. And the next game I'm covering today is Command HQ from Ozark Software, developed once again by Dan Bunton. As stated in previous episodes, Dan Bunton was later known as Danielle Bunton Berry. She referred to her work from before she transitioned with her previous name and pronouns, so I will do the same. In all honesty, I need to do a full developer profile episode on Danielle because her work is incredibly important to gaming history. I'm not diving into it in this series, but Dan's game Mule is one of the most influential games of all time and was reportedly one of the main influences for the Warcraft games. Sadly, Bunton Berry passed away in 1998, otherwise I would love to try to get her on the show. Anyways, Bunton's game, Command HQ, was released in 1990 for MS-DOS and Classic Mac. This game more closely resembles what we know RTS games to look like now than most of the other games we've talked about so far. In Command HQ, you can choose from a variety of different scenarios to play through. 1918, which is World War I, 1942, which is World War II, 1986, which is World War III. That one I'm a little confused by. Is it fictional? It's not. It's probably referring to the Cold War, but I digress. And 2023, which is alternative history. But since I wasn't able to play this game, I'm really curious as to what the World War III and 2023 scenarios are like. In all scenarios except for 2023, the world map is made completely visible. There's no fog of war. In 2023, player's starting locations are randomized and the entire map is shrouded in fog of war, helping immerse the player in the scenario's post-apocalyptic aesthetic. There is a beginning phase in each scenario where players have a time limit to build and place units in their starting points, similar to how Risk is played, where you place your armies before the game begins in earnest. When the game goes into full swing, players must control their armies, manage their economies, tend to their relationships with foreign countries, and so much more. It's kind of like what would later become the 4X genre. Command HQ also allowed online multiplayer. Players could connect and play matches with each other via dial-up internet or even in person using a null modem cable to connect their computers to each other. In fact, you can play this game now on DOSBox and still play online with friends today. The next game I'm talking about today, I'm only including because it's sort of a sequel to one of the games I talked about in a previous History of RTS episode. This game is J.R.R. Tolkien's Riders of Rohan, and from a macro perspective, it kind of seems like it would fit perfectly into the RTS genre. There are various unit types for both good guys and bad guys. You have heroes that are stronger than your average soldier that you can control, and you can move them around in real time on a map. However, I can't help but feel this is just a crappy shovelware title. The combat feels like an afterthought, so much so that when two armies collide on the main map, you can choose to either have the computer sim out the battle or jump into the fray and directly command the troops in that army. If you do decide to jump into battle and command them, the combat is slow and really feels like the battle is decided based solely on troop numbers and not on any strategy you could actually employ. Some of the things I will say that I like, though, is that prior to entering battle, you can see a scouting report to let you know how many soldiers you have and how many the enemy has. This then lets you decide to engage or retreat. But there really wasn't much more that I have to say about this game other than it's a licensed game based off of Lord of the Rings, and strangely enough, in North America, it was published by Konami. Next up is 1991's Megalomania from Sensible Software. This game is massive in scope, and while it does not provide a lot of gameplay depth in terms of combat, it does provide an insane amount of depth to the other half of the RTS equation, resource gathering and technology. Megalomania's biggest contribution to the genre is how it focused on micromanaging the economy and tech. The game has players assign their villagers/workers to various tasks like mining, gathering resources, refining those resources, researching new technology, breeding, joining the military, etc. The game begins with the player controlling only unarmed men. They then have to assign those men to the various tasks mentioned before to help them advance. It's actually the first game in the RTS genre to use tech trees. Developing one technology will give way to more options and more advanced tech for you to research and obtain. The overall premise of the game is you, the player, takes control of one of four different gods: Caesar, Madcap, Oberon, and Scarlet. There's no real difference between the four of them in terms of gameplay other than the color and their behavior when they are an AI that you're facing. The game places you on an island with the other gods, and you have to defeat all of them. Once you conquer an island, you move on to the next one. And the objective is to conquer enough islands that you literally move through time and advance from the year 9500 BC to 2001 AD. But the way the game organizes this is that after conquering three islands, the player moves on to the next epoch/period of history. Each epoch is at a different time period. During the first one, like I mentioned before, it's 9500 BC. The second epoch, or the next three islands, is 3000 BC, etc. And then in total, there are 10 epochs, which, like I said, will take you up to the year 2001. Any units that survive will get carried over to the next epoch, where the player is given an additional 100 units. The overall objective is to progress through each epoch until the end of the game. The game also featured a simple diplomacy system where players could ally themselves with one of the other gods. While allied, they could not attack or take each other's lands. However, no alliances could be formed if there were only two gods left. One final note on Megalomania. It was ported to the Sega Genesis/Mega Drive, but under the name Tyrants Fight Through Time, and I actually have this game, and I was very confused when I first tried to play it. But doing research for this series now, I actually know it's a port of Megalomania, and I just didn't understand what the objective was at the time, so it looks like I have to go back and give this game another shot. So we are down to actually only two games left on this History of RTS episode, but the first of the two I'm only going to touch on. Utopia, Creation of a Nation, was developed by Celestial Software and released in 1991 for the Amiga, Atari ST, and MS-DOS. It was later ported to the Super Nintendo in 1993. As far as I'm aware, this game has no affiliation with the original Utopia game that I went through in the first episode of this RTS series. What's interesting about this game is that it's predominantly a city builder game. Think SimCity, but with more options. And I'm not throwing shade at SimCity either. The original SimCity came out in 1989, so this was a solid 3 years later than that. The objective of this game is to colonize a new planet and build your city and civilization to the point where it reaches quote-unquote utopia. However, there is an alien race that also lands on the planet, and they're racing you to make it to utopia. Having an enemy to compete against is a huge factor for this game, and while you can't ally yourself with the alien race, you can use espionage to either spy or sabotage them. There is also heavy micromanagement mechanics in this game. Players can control tax rates, trade, and even the birth rate. So, why am I including this game on this list? Well, there is a small tactical component to it. The way to technically win the game is to get your civilization's morale up to 80%. And the easiest way to do that is to just take out the enemy race. The combat and tactical components of this game are very rudimentary. You can build various unit types like tanks or helicopters and use them to attack the enemy civilization. From what I could tell, there isn't much strategy involved, so there isn't much else to speak on with this. However, if any of you out there have played this game, I would love some more insight into it. And now on to our final game, and the most important game of this episode in my opinion. Dune 2, The Building of a Dynasty, or just Dune 2 for short. Dune 2 was developed by Westwood Studios for MS-DOS in 1992, but was later ported to the Amiga and the Sega Genesis / Mega Drive in 1993. And another port it got was to a strange operating system that I haven't heard of prior to this called the RISC OS, R-I-S-C OS, and that happened in 1995. This is the last game for this episode for a very good reason. First, like I said before, it was developed by Westwood Studios. This is the same developer who would go on to make Command & Conquer. Second, it's the first game to be placed in the genre of real-time strategy, meaning this is the game that coined the term for the genre. It's also the game that arguably laid the framework for what RTS games would become. But let's first look at how Dune 2 came to be. Virgin Interactive bought the rights to make a video game adaptation of the 1984 movie. That movie, which was directed by David Lynch, by the way, was an adaptation of a novel by Frank Herbert. Virgin initially tapped a small French development studio named Cryo to helm this game. However, they quickly became unhappy with Cryo's infrequent updates on the status of their game and scrapped their version and instead gave it to Westwood Studios. There was a pretty big problem though. No one told Cryo. So they kept making their game and it actually got released. And since they were given the first crack of the apple, their game was called Dune and Westwood's game would go on to be called Dune 2. During development of Dune 2, the devs played and took a lot of inspiration from Herzog's Pie, the game I mentioned as the final game in the last History of RTS episode. This led them to refine the RTS style from Herzog's Pie to their own liking. This is a very quick summary of the events that happened, so I would encourage all of you to look into it more, because it really is an interesting story. The groundwork Dune 2 laid is beyond impressive. It starts players out with a base and a few soldiers. From there, the players can build a construction yard, which allows them to make other adjacent buildings, such as wind traps or refineries. Each new building constructed will open additional options for the players. If a player constructs a building on the sand, that building would start partially damaged. However, if they constructed a concrete slab first to stabilize the building and then build it on top of that, instead of the shifting dunes, the building would start at full health. Besides just your military production buildings, players could also build defensive structures such as walls and turrets. What's strange to me, though, is how the buildings are made. Unlike more modern RTS games where you have workers or villagers to build your base, in Dune 2, once you select a building to build, it will do it on its own behind the scenes, and once it's complete, you can then choose where you want to place it. Where the game shows its age the most is in its controls. Players can only select one unit at a time, and they cannot group them together like you can in later RTS games. Once a unit is selected, the player would then have to move the mouse over to the sidebar on the right and pick an action for the unit to execute. Nowadays, all these commands would be done with the mouse or a hotkey. The commands the players had to choose from were move, attack, retreat, and guard. And there's others too, but those were the four main ones. The economy of the game revolved around one resource, spice, which makes sense considering that it takes place in the Dune universe. Players have to fight for every bit of spice they can get their hands on to fund building their army. This is a major difference compared to what we are used to in the current RTS games, where there's at least two resources, and some even have 4 to 5. One last note, though, on Dune 2 before we wrap up the episode. There was a remake of the game called Dune 2000 that was developed by Intelligent Games and released in 1998. However, that developer is probably more famous for their previous game, Command & Conquer Red Alert. But that game and that series is a topic for another episode. So that's it for this episode of The History of RTS. Thank you all for listening. And I've, like I said a bunch of times so far, I'm really enjoying this series because I'm learning so much, and I hope you are too. As usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to email me, you can email me at StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. As of recording, I am currently working on my Patreon benefits, so that way you guys can actually get something better than just, well, nothing, in all honesty. So I've already started planning stuff out, so look for, you'll be able to see that soon. So if you want to support the show, go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. You can also give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. And the most important shout out is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. If you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that will do it for this episode of Still Loading. Thank you all for listening. I hope you've been enjoying this History of RTS series. Thank you all for listening. I will see you all next time.